Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the Fat Lot of Good podcast. It's me, Helen Thorne. Now, I'm really excited to tell you, everyone, that this podcast is sponsored by the fabulous F&F Clothing. I love this brand. F&F make clothing for women, which will make you feel gorgeous. And the best news is it won't even break the bank. I love these guys. This week, I'm wearing a fabulous cotton frock. Now, not only is it gorgeous, but I want to tell you that F&F are the first UK supermarket to sign up to the Better Cotton Initiative. The BCI exists to make global cotton production better for the people who produce it, better for the environment it grows in, and better for the sector's future by developing better cotton as a sustainable mainstream commodity. How good is this? So go and grab some gorgeous cotton clothes from F&F Clothing today. Personally, I love their jeans and their jumpsuits. They're my favourite in the collection. And also, you can get them from sizes 6 to 22. So go on, go to your local Tesco Extra shop or shop online through next.co.uk and follow F&F Clothing on all your social medias. Now, let the podcast begin. Hello and welcome to the Fat Lot of Good podcast. It's me, Helen Thorne. I'm a comedian, writer. I'm one half of the Scummy Mummies. I am extra excited. I am beside myself because today, people, I finally got her in the room with me. It's Laura Thomas. Hello.
Oh my God, I feel like I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to sustain that throughout
I've peaked very early in the podcast. Oh my God, I am in love with this one. I'm obsessed. Laura Thomas, PhD. She has been mentioned on this podcast a couple of times already by our guests. We've had Clemmie Telford, who sung your praises very loudly, and of course the wonderful Sarah Powell, and so many people I know online and in real life praise you very highly. She's written a book that it's called Just Eat It. Can you do the longer bit of the book? Because I forgot how do you say it? Just Eat It.
How intuitive you think can help you get your shit together around food.
Excellent. And it has, you shouldn't throw this around too glibly about how a book changes your life. Well, fuck it. It has. It's changed my life. Thank you very much, Laura Thomas. I know. Gosh. And now we're going out. We're dating now. But in a nutshell, Laura Thomas is a nutritionist, mm-hmm. and you have written this fabulous book called Just Eat It, which was released this year. And also you were the woman behind the London Intuitive Eating.
London Centre for Intuitive Eating, that's the name of my clinic.
Yes, excellent. All right, well let's just get into it.
Let's because do it.
I think the first question that everybody wants to fucking ask you every day of your life until you die, what the hell is intuitive eating, Laura?
Oh my God, what is it? And you know, it's been like 6 months since the book came out and I still haven't quite got this like down as concisely as I should
do. We've got a few minutes.
Bear with me. You can chat. But yeah, just it's a framework that was actually developed in the 1990s by two dietitians, Evelyn Tribbley and Elise Resch, if I could get her name out, who I've had the great privilege of training with. And they created this framework because they kept seeing the same pattern in their clients, that they were going round and round and round that dieting merry-go-round. They were going round that cycle. And Elise and Evelyn were kind of giving them these meticulous meal plans and being like, you know, just follow that down to the letter. And even when the clients were following it down to the letter, it wasn't working. Their relationship with food was kind of in tatters, really. And so it's something that I wanted to introduce into my own practice because I was seeing similar things in my clients. Their relationship with food, they were really struggling with that. They were feeling a lot of guilt or shame or anxiety about the foods that they were eating, or they were just struggling around food. There was a lot of bargaining and negotiating and back and forth in their head about good foods and bad foods and all of this noise. And so intuitive eating is a framework to help you just dial down that noise, essentially. It's a set of 10 principles that help you get rid of all of that noise and then essentially teach you how to learn to eat again from the ground up. That's how I like to explain it to my clients anyway.
It's one of those books I just want to go, yes, yes, on every page. Because what I like to, when the book starts, is you sort of unpick the bullshit of the dieting culture.
Mm.
Because I think everybody who's listened to this podcast, good chance that you have been on at least one diet where you have to, yeah, you either have to restrict something or you're weighing how many nuts you're going to eat or what time you should eat and all those sort of things, which is kind of the complete opposite to what intuitive eating is, about reading your body signs and things like that. And, you know, I think one of the strongest messages from the books is that diets are set up to fail you. And that, you know, and you start with such hope, and you illustrate this so beautifully in the book, that cycle of, like, you know, you go into it all guns blazing, like in the first week you're like, yes, this is going to change my life, this is the new me, I'm going to love me because I'm going to lose, you know, however much weight to make this supposedly perfect body, and then you fail. And then you hate yourself, and then you binge eat, and then it just all kind of, and then you do this again until you die, basically. You just go round and around. And I've known that because I've gone like, oh, the 5-2 diet's going to be for me, or I'm going to do Atkins, or I'm going to do all sorts of things, and all of that which have left me not feeling great at all.
And I think the thing that gets quite tricky is that even if we're not on a formal diet, like the 5-2, like Atkins, like whatever else it is, we still collated all of these rules and restrictions and kind of bargaining and negotiating that goes on in our head, like I kind of mentioned before, that has come from diet culture. So whether we've absorbed that from our family or from Women's Health magazine or just something we've picked up on social media, it all kind of gets lodged deeper and deeper into our psyche.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to unpick it, especially when culture keeps reinforcing that stuff back at you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I'm like, yeah, you pick up any magazine and, yeah, even if it's Today, but, yeah, those rules are lodged in your head. I know when Clemmy Telford was on the podcast, she's like, oh, I didn't eat pasta during the week, or pasta was only for the weekends, and she created her own rules. And even I remember reading that fantastic article Dolly Alderton wrote about you. She had written like, well, I knew I was going to have a big lunch the next day, so I didn't eat like this. And you play off all this sort of, you play it all off in your head and weighing it up.
It's just like a maths puzzle in your head constantly that is unsolvable.
How would you describe, I guess, the bullshit of diet culture? Because I think it's still continuing today. Every day a new diet plan is launched every time. Mm-hmm. So why is it important that we ignore that shit? Because it promises so much. I think that's what the thing is, that you get like the before and after shots. You get all these sort of triggers that going, but if I just do this for 6 weeks, I'm going to look like a Kardashian. Or if I just, you know, only eat grapefruit for breakfast or whatever, I'll look like Kate Moss. Mm-hmm. So how do we start to, I guess, what are ways of protecting ourselves against those false promises?
So I think, first of all, just having an awareness that we live in diet culture it's so many people are just not aware that this is what's being fed back to them constantly.
Yeah.
And so unless you see it, you can't actively push back and fight against it. So I think like that's half of the battle. Mm. And letting yourself kind of get angry about that. Get angry that we've always been told to equate our worth with thinness. We've been taught to equate health with thinness. We've been sold all this bullshit, all of these lies for so long. And I don't know, that makes me angry. I don't know about you, but that really pisses me off. And I think it's okay to almost go through the grieving process when it comes to letting go of diet culture, because so much of us, our identities are really caught up in that. And so it can be really difficult to let go and sort of ask that difficult question of like, okay, well, if I'm not the healthy one, or, you know, the good fatty, always trying to be on a diet, always trying to lose weight, then who am I? And that's a really tough question to answer. But I think for me and for a lot of clients that I work with, the that sort of missing piece of the puzzle of getting over diet culture is learning about the sort of feminist aspect of diet culture. And Naomi Wolf said in The Beauty Myth that dieting is the most potent political sedative that we have. And so it's stopping us. Like, we're literally so hungry that we can't think about, we don't have the capacity for anything outside of ourselves. If you think about it,
we can't smash the glass ceiling if we're tired and hungry.
Well, exactly. We're constantly body checking. We're constantly preoccupied with food. I remember being on a diet and sort of scrolling for hours through Pinterest, just looking at pictures of food. Like, that's not healthy. And we've all been there.
We've all been there. I know. And especially when you do things like the 5-2 or anything which is calorifically restricted, you spend four times as much time in the supermarket. You're like, but I can't eat this sandwich because it's 500 calories and I can't do this. And you just, you go mental. Mm-hmm. You literally lose your mind to food when it should be a joy and B, just part of daily life.
Well, it's essential.
You don't time when you take a shit. You go I'm only going to do one shit today. You don't know how many times you're going to do a shit or when it's going to come. You're in tune with when you need to go to the toilet, when food is coming out.
When you need to sleep, when you need to sneeze, when you need to cough, when you need to pee, all of these other bodily functions, we just get on with it.
Yeah.
But when it comes to something so base as feeding ourselves, we just overcomplicate it, second guess ourselves, overthink it. And that keeps us distracted from bigger picture issues that are going on all around us.
That's right. We've got jobs to do, women.
We've got stuff to do.
Right. So one of the big hurdles I have with food is emotional eating. And that's one of the things that you talk about so brilliantly in your book and through your podcast, is that you have those moments where you go, fuck it, I just want to eat a tub of ice cream, or fuck it, I want to drink a lot of cocktails, or you go to the supermarket and you're like, fuck it, I'm going to eat a bag of Haribo and that will make me feel better.
Yeah.
So we all do it. We've all got those crutches, or when you're having a bit of a low day, you're like, I just want to eat a big bowl of macaroni cheese. What is your advice to people? Because I think that's that cycle where you go, I just need this to make me feel better, and then you beat yourself up because you've eaten kilos of crap, basically. Yeah. So what would you say to the listeners out there about emotional eating?
There's so much to say on this, and it's so layered. So stick with me, because I could honestly, and I have done, just talk about this all day long. Mm. But the first thing that I would just, I guess, put out there is comfort eating, emotional eating, stress eating, whatever you want to call it, is totally normal.
Okay.
It's totally fine.
We're okay, people. Let's all give ourselves a hug. It's all right.
Right. And the way that I look at emotional eating and comfort eating is it's a signal that our bodies are telling us, are trying to communicate something with us. Something is out of whack. Something is off kilter. Maybe you're just on your freaking period and you need a bowl of mac and cheese.
Yeah.
And that is okay. The problem, I think, is when – well, two sort of different problems. I think the problem is potentially when we beat ourselves up and give ourselves shit for that.
Yeah.
For something that's just normal and, helpful.
We're normal listeners.
It's helpful, right? Yeah, it's serving a function. Emotional eating is serving a function. So can we take a step back and look at that as a clue that something else is going on for us, right? And maybe there is nothing else going on for us, and it's just that we want some mac and cheese, and that's perfectly fine as well.
Yeah.
The second thing that I kind of think about when I'm working with clients on this is emotional eating in and of itself isn't inherently a problem.
Yeah.
It's, like I said, we're doing something to look after ourselves. We're trying to take care of ourselves. We're trying to self-soothe. The problem only becomes if that's our only way of looking after ourselves.
Right, yeah.
If we don't have anything else in that sort of emotional coping toolkit, if we don't have other, whether it's self-care practices or just downtime, getting enough rest, therapy, meditation, yoga, whatever your thing is, maybe it's just walking your dog, maybe it's getting on the phone to your mom, maybe it's, going for a walk with your friend, whatever it is,
yeah.
Making sure that we can fill up that toolkit. So, because if emotional eating is the only thing that's in there, and we reach in and pull it out and say, no, that's bad, you have to stop doing that.
Yeah.
What are we left with?
Mm.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And that's not helpful either.
Yeah.
But I think if we can even just take a step back from the concept of emotional eating, which we've established is not bad and is
good.
If that's how you're looking after yourself, cool.
Yeah.
Because what I often see in my practice is that people misidentify hunger for emotional eating.
Yeah.
So what I see a lot of is people just eating like tiny birds throughout the day. And then come 7 o'clock, when they come home, they like face plant into the fridge and they call it emotional eating. That's not emotional eating. That is, you have not eaten enough food throughout the day to sustain and nourish your body. You're hungry.
Yeah.
That is hunger. And it's easy for us to laugh about it, but we're so out of touch with what's going on in our bodies. We're just like, and this is another problem with diet culture, is it encourages us to overthink and overcomplicate food and get stuck in our heads about it rather than tuning into what's going on in our bodies.
Yeah.
And what I notice is if we can get some, you know, substantial meals going and some snacks throughout the day, that emotional eating or that perceived emotional eating takes care of itself.
Yeah. I know I've noticed even in the last couple of weeks since reading your book, because I used to go, oh, no, I'll just wait until this time to have lunch or, you know, I'll do this. But then I just got so hungry, I would eat an entire packet of, what's it called, crisp bread and a whole tub of hummus. Mm. Because I'd just go, oh, you know. And now I just go, no, I'm just going to have a snack that I like. And then I'll keep going, or I ate too much, you know, for dinner that night, and I won't have breakfast, but I'll eat at 11, and that'll be fine. But I used to have all these different kind of rules, but now I just go, I'm just going to have a little bit when I'm hungry, so I don't get to that point where I will just literally eat an entire tray of lasagna,
where you don't want to inhale your food.
Yeah, and do it really quickly, and also just things like and not eating at the fridge. So just having a consciousness.
I mean, no shame.
do you know why? And I have mentioned this before. I do like a Jarlsberg or an Emmental slice, and I have known to eat 5 slices in a row just because I'm like, I'm hungry. I want another one of those. Hit me again, and then I've nearly finished a whole packet of cheese slices.
I mean,
in one go.
Sounds like a decent snack to me.
It is good. Oh yes, can we talk about snacks actually? Because I think that's one of those things that we really punish ourselves about, like, oh, no snacking, and then you're just so bloody hungry that you'll eat, you know, 4 sandwiches at lunchtime. What are some really good snacks that will keep you going, actually sustains you?
Well, I think everyone's different in terms of what they like and enjoy and what satisfies them and what fills them up and what they're looking forward to eating. And those are all important considerations. I hate to be the nutritionist who's like, you should eat oatcakes and hummus, or you should do this, or you should do that. I tend to think about, okay, let's maybe try and experiment a little bit with snacks, figure out what works for us, what feels good in our body. I often try and say get 2 out of 3 of protein, fat, and carbohydrate, just so it's a bit balanced. Mm-hmm. And because oftentimes I'll see people eat like fruit as a snack. That's not a snack. That's part of a snack.
Yeah.
But if you were to add some peanut butter on there or, I don't know, have some cheese and crackers with it, that's a snack.
Yeah.
but the point that I'm trying to make is just to try and get a bit of some sort of semblance of balance in there, so that it does actually tide you over. It does fill you up. An apple's not going to do that, at least not for very long. That's no shade to apples.
I mean, we're very pro apples here on the podcast.
But an apple is something you have, like, if you're going to be eating in like 1/2 hour, not in 3 hours.
Yeah.
You know? Or you have it with something else.
Yeah.
I have a lot of thoughts about snacks, as you can tell.
Yeah. So in terms of like things that you would fill your cupboard with, like what would be in your, I mean, I know everybody's different, but good sort of staples that, like, so you're not always grabbing a Mars bar or whatever. What would you fill your cupboard with in terms of, like, you know, a big pot of nut butter, a big da 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 da? Like, are there things?
I mean, I have chocolate bars in my house.
I've got a frozen Mars bar in my freezer right now, and let's pause to think about that for a minute. But yeah, I mean, obviously, in addition to all the chocolate
I guess in terms of staples, I think having like store cupboard things like granola bars and like fruit and nut bars, packets of like savory, like I'm big on savory snacks.
Yeah.
I really like Love Corn. Have you come across them?
Shut up. Tell me about it.
So good. So it's like, they're like crunchy corn, but not that like crunchy corn that breaks your teeth. Like
yeah.
crunchy corn, like
popcorn. Yeah,
kind
like Rice Krispies.
But not popcorn, because okay. popcorn's bullshit in okay. my opinion.
Ooh, heard it here
I
first.
Told you, I have strong opinions about snacks.
No popcorn,
but,
guys.
But they're... Well, yeah, there's nothing wrong with popcorn, but just like, again, that skinny popcorn does my nut.
Okay.
So, yeah, like Love Corn, they have this barbecue flavor. That's really good. Really good. So I'm just thinking, because we have a ton of snacks in our office, and we just got a delivery of a bunch of Naked bars today.
They're really good.
But again, quite small.
Mm.
I would need something else with a Naked bar.
Yes.
Let's see. We also get those like oat biscuits. Those are pretty good. So those are all like your store cupboard. And then I think yogurt, cheese, crackers, biscuits, like just.
Excellent.
Use your imagination.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You don't need me to tell you what to eat.
No, you don't. This is the wonderful
you
thing.
You know yourself what feels good and what's going to fill you up, what's going to satisfy you, what's going to give you energy, what's going to give you that sense of well-being.
Mm.
And that is the crux of intuitive eating. It's not me being like the food police and being like, oh, Helen, show me what's in your cupboards.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
me going through it, like, you know, laying it all out on the
Julie
table.
McKeith.
Julie McKeith style.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
what I was thinking.
I know. That was scary.
That's like old school nutrition. We're past that.
Yeah, and also that was filled with so much shame as well. Like, right. you know, you felt shame about what you looked like, shame about what you ate, when you ate it, who you ate it with, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. So I think that's such a big thing to sort of unpick as well. And also you make rules for yourself, like, oh, I've always been fat, or I always make bad choices. So as soon as you go to like going out for the restaurant, so to speak, you go oh, but I always have a burger, or I always do this. So are they some of the issues or problems people come to you with, is that you're just always making you feel like you're making bad choices?
So you see, it's so interesting how we're looking at this differently. And you're asking me if people come to me because they see this particular behavior as a problem,
yeah.
right? Like, oh, I have a burger, I get a takeaway, I get this, I get that. I actually don't see that as the issue here.
Yeah.
What I see as the issue is the self-judgment, is the self-criticism, is the blaming and the shaming. And the kind of internalizing all of these messages that we've absorbed from diet culture about like the negative stereotypes attributed to people at a higher body weight, to fat people, to, you know, the sort of virtue signaling of thinness. And you think that thin people don't eat takeaways and pizza and all that kind of stuff? Of course
no,
they do.
No, they're just eating carrot sticks and having low-fat
and apples,
smoothies.
Fucking apples and skinny popcorn. They're not.
We found a trigger warning, people. Apples and popcorn.
but these are the messages and the judgments that we internalize, and we kind of then just like fire those off at ourselves constantly, and that to me is more harmful than if you're eating a takeaway.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com. Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
One of the phrases that I find so, it's sort of like a mixed compliment when someone says, "You look so great, have you lost weight?" And no. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's just one of those things. It's like, you can only be valued or praised if you've shrunk yourself a bit. Mm-hmm. And I think that, it was really funny a couple of years ago when I went back to Australia, because every time I go home, I feel like I have to have achieved something. When I see my friends, because I want to feel like I've come back. I'm like, yes, I've done something amazing on the other side of the world kind of thing. And I thought, I've got to lose weight and I have to do better at comedy because, you know, they're the things. I have to be good at, successful in my career and smaller. And that would be the first thing people said, oh, my God, you look so good. Have you lost weight? And I was like, yes, I'm a good person because I've lost weight. And it's a weird thing. And you kind of, not you get high from it, but you go, oh, yes, I am a success. Because I'm smaller. And that's taken me years to kind of unpick. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, they'll still like me if I'm a size 18. Mm-hmm. It's going to be okay. And yeah. I think, I just felt so much better after reading your book. I know I've said it like 7 times already on this podcast, but it finally made sense because it wasn't a finite thing. Like in terms of, it wasn't like, just do this for 12 weeks or do this for 6 weeks or whatever. And then... Mm. You'll be smaller and, you know, happily ever after kind of thing. But this felt like this is forever now, this intuitive eating.
I think that's such an important point that you're making, because oftentimes people will approach intuitive eating with that kind of mindset of like, okay, this is the thing, it's going to sort me out. And they treat it almost like another diet, and then they join all the Facebook groups and listen to all the podcasts. And you should still listen to my podcast. But
it is excellent. can we say the name of your podcast again?
It's called Don't Salt My Game.
It's excellent. Thank you. On her website. Anyway, go.
But you know, they buy all the books and kind of almost approach it the way that they would with another diet. Mm. And so oftentimes I'm saying to my clients, like, slow your fucking roll. Like, calm down here.
Yeah.
Let's just take it really gently and easily, because, you know, my hope for you by the time that you've gone through this process, by the time we finish working together, is that you're not thinking about food. You're not thinking about nutrition all that much. You know, you're thinking about it an appropriate amount, but it's not taking over your whole life. And so intuitive eating just kind of very gradually and seamlessly just becomes part of your life. It's and not a major part of your life. It doesn't define you.
Yes.
It's just kind of how you eat. It's how we were born, you know, knowing how to eat and being really in touch with our body signals. Mm. That's kind of where I want you to be.
Yeah, because as you sort of so beautifully illustrate in the book, is like when you feed babies, when they're full, they just shake their head or they throw their food on the floor.
Give it to the dog.
Yeah. They know when they're full, or they know when they're hungry. And I see that with my own children. Like, some days you think, fucking hell, how many snacks or how much are you going to eat? And then other days they live off air. You're like, please have some yogurt, have something. But they're much more in tune. And I have those. Now I'm trying to to read my hunger much better, because I used to sort of feel like being hungry was almost like a reward, or you're winning, because like, oh, I'm hungry, that means, you know, I'm potentially losing weight, or I'm beating my body kind of thing.
I had a client once tell me, this is so sad, but a client once tell me that going to bed hungry at night gave her a sense of accomplishment.
Oh, God.
When we look at it just in isolation like that, that feels really extreme, but there are probably a lot of us who have thought quite similarly, and that's really damaging, I think.
And I've won the prize. Yeah. And so in terms of like the arc that you have with your clients, obviously people come to you with a host of different I don't want to say issues, but reasons that they come to sort of see. I guess they've already made that first step, haven't they, in recognizing That there's a problem that they need to solve, or they want to get better at feeding themselves. That sounds so
it sounds so weird when you say it like that. How do I eat food?
How do I eat? But it is almost down to that, though. Yeah. It's like, because we're just sort of layered with all this bullshit. But also, I also want to talk about the body positive movement, because this didn't exist, I think, you know, so overtly when we were growing up. We saw images of skinny girls in the movies and in magazines, but now because of Instagram, we're seeing much more of a variety of bodies. Mm-hmm. But I like the way you talked about body positivity, not in glowing terms, but also that we can't love our bodies all the time, and what we should or we can aim for is body neutrality. Mm. Do you want to speak a bit more about that?
Yeah, well, I'd actually just like to speak quickly to the kind of history of body positivity, because I think maybe I've messed up when I wrote the book, but people seem to think that I'm like against body positivity or something like that. And I think the conversation is just a bit more nuanced in that, you know, body positivity started out as a social justice issue, right? So it was fat, queer, black and Jewish women in the 60s and 70s who were really, really radical fatties, like burning diet books in the middle of parks and like, you know, it was a political act. And it was really a movement that was created for the most marginalized bodies. And so we were kind of talking off mic about how I don't really want to talk much about my own body image because I'm a straight-sized, white, relatively young, blonde hair, blue-eyed woman. So that this movement was just not created for me, and I don't want to take up space in it.
Yeah.
What we've seen over especially the past couple of years, it's really tricky because on one hand, we are – with body positivity, we are seeing – companies being held more accountable for showing body diversity, whatever that looks like, in their advertising campaigns, in the models that they're using. And I think that is a really great thing. I worry that it's maybe tokenistic, but we'll see how that plays out. Mm. The other thing that I've also seen is a kind of co-option of body positivity by diet culture. So perfect example of this is fucking Weight Watchers, or WW, whatever they're calling themselves now, who are claiming that they're body positive. You can't be body positive and tell people that their bodies are wrong and you need to change your body and you need to shrink your body. Those two things, those ideas are antithetical to one another. So that's a big problem, this kind of co-option of body positivity. And then I think the third thing is, and it's kind of related in that now on Instagram, we see a lot of Transformation Tuesdays that are hashtag body positive. We see a lot of, you know, very and this is not to shame anyone's bodies, but we see people who that movement was not created for kind of coming in and being like, oh, I'm body positive. And and it's just not that they don't have difficulties appreciating their body, but it's a lot easier because they're not living under multiple layers of marginalization. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I know, because I've seen Instagrammers not complain, but sort of saying, I don't feel I'm part, why can't I be in the body positive movement because I'm a size 10 and I feel like I'm being marginalised by body positivity. And I'm like, oh God, this has got too meta. This has got too, this is not what it's, and it's a shame because I think, it came from such a strong, amazing place where people were trying to get back power and trying to make a very strong point about, especially in the, where it started in the US, where people were being refused healthcare and all sorts of things. Like this is life
it's a political,
and death.
Yeah.
Life and death. Yeah.
Yeah. Political movement. You know, everyone does, of course, deserve to access body positivity. But I think a lot of it is maybe quite performative when we could actually just kind of use that for ourselves in our own sort of private space, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I think because of that, I had a lot of clients who were going on Instagram and being like, this body positivity thing, just like that doesn't make sense for me. I've had kids. My body's changed. I'm older. I've had injuries. I've had, surgeries, all kinds of things, mastectomies, you know, things that change your body and your relationship to it. And this idea of kind of like, unicorns and rainbows body positivity is just a bit too far out of reach for those people.
Mm.
And so I came across the concept of body neutrality, and I thought, you know, this makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
It's acknowledging that because we live in diet culture and because we've been taught to blame everything on our bodies whenever, you know, we're having a bad day about something, we take it out on our bodies.
Mm.
What body neutrality is kind of inviting you to, you know, acknowledge that you are going to have bad body image days. But what counts really is how you respond to that in the moment. Can you treat your body with respect despite the fact that society is telling you there's something wrong with it? Can you still nourish it? Can you look after it, move it, or rest it in a way that feels supportive and helps you take care of yourself rather than going down the spiral of dieting and disordered eating?
Mm. I've seen so many people on Instagram apologize, going, "Oh, I can't get to body positivity. I can't." And it's like, well, you don't have to. You don't have to love your body all the time.
Yeah.
And also, you're allowed to say, "I would like to lose some weight." But, you know, that and that's okay. You're like, or I'd like to move more, or I'd like to get into exercise and all those sort of things. But there are so many barriers, and people automatically think they're going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what that stopped me from doing exercise for many years, like going, I'm not very bendy, I'm really slow, I'm really fat. Like every time I went to yoga, I can't sit on my heels. I don't know if there's any other listeners out there.
I can't.
Yeah, and I feel like so when everyone was like sort of sat back on their heels in these sort of elegant poses, I just have my bum up in the air,
yeah.
Like some kind of I don't know. I'm going to say something negative about my body, so I'll stop myself. But all those sort of things, like just weird things, like my body doesn't do what everybody else's body, and I don't like that, and then I just want to apologize, and then I'll go home. I'm like, well, I'll just eat 7 cheese toasties, and then I'll feel better because I'm very good at eating cheese toasties, but I can't bend. But now I've just gone. Fuck it. I will go to yoga.
And it's so interesting that what you've just said there is that, you know, it's just kind of typical of how we approach this in our society, is that we blame ourselves for this.
Yeah.
When actually I was thinking, why is that yoga teacher not coming in and kind of helping you adjust your posture or giving you some support or just saying, it's okay if you can't touch your heels. It's okay if you're not quite there yet. It's a practice. We're going to work towards it.
Yeah.
And I think the difficulty, this is a whole other podcast now, but, you know, yoga teachers are trained on other yoga teachers who have, you know, who are generally, and things I think are maybe starting to shift now, but are generally straight-sized, petite, young, and very bendy and flexible because they do yoga all the time, which is fine. but what happens when someone who has other requirements comes into their class? I know one yoga teacher who works with amputees, for example, another teacher who works with refugees, and other yoga teachers who work with bigger bodies. But that's almost like an extra layer of specialist training that people have to get. It's not it's not baked into their yoga teacher training.
Yeah, no, and this is a bit like, you know, the clothing brands that only go up to size 16.
Ugh.
We're like, ah! But yeah, so the fashion designers and, you know, like the sample sizes are always 8 or 10, or the models are always 8 or 10. I mean, obviously that's changing. But then, you have to have the plus size range, or you have to have like the separate fat section, when these bodies, there's just as many size 10s as there is size 18s, or et cetera.
Yeah.
That we're so marginalized as soon as you're above a size 16 for everything.
It's a real problem.
Yeah.
And I can't say this from personal experience, but through working with clients in bigger bodies and trying to help them navigate that, and just kind of having, I guess, some sense of the challenges that they face. And I think when you are straight sized, that's just not something that you have to think about or consider. And that's where the privilege lies, right? Is that you don't have to think about that. You don't have to think about going to a specialist shop or only having a tiny corner in one side of the shop to shop from, or having to order things online. And and that's only one aspect of your life, right? That's only clothes.
Yeah.
What about all of the other ways in which weight stigma plays out in education, in employment, in medical care? It's vast.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, yeah, and I would recommend Sophie Hagen's amazing book,
yes,
Happy Fat, which she speaks so beautifully about that. Just, yeah, and being a good friend, being a good fat friend as well. About, yeah, she was saying about when she went to the theatre and she couldn't sit, she couldn't fit in the seat, and she said her friend was much more worried about it and her friend was much more embarrassed about it than she was. And she's like, no, it's fine. It was fine, you know. And she said the main thing for her is that don't, as a friend, you don't need to overreact. It's okay. Yeah. And then, yeah, everyone was feeling uncomfortable. It was like, no, it's all right. It's okay. Where can people find you, and what tools have you given this planet? Obviously, the book is excellent, but more than that, you've got some online courses. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I think probably the first place to start would be my podcast, which we mentioned, Don't Salt My Game.
It's free.
So that's free. Good. And my Instagram is also free, and I put a lot of stuff on there. So
abnormally generous you are.
Then, yeah, my book, Just Eat It, How Intuitive Eating Can Help You Get Your Shit Together Around Food. And then, yeah, we have online courses for individuals who want to kind of deepen their intuitive eating practice. We also have ones for parents who are like, I'm worried that I might have been putting some of my stuff around food onto my kids. How can I help raise them in a way that they stay in touch with their hunger and their fullness signals? So we have a course around that. And then we also do one-on-one sessions, and that's kind of our thing. So I have a team of clinicians, and we help people work through food and body image stuff. We can also work with people who are trying to navigate a health concern through a lens of intuitive eating. So yeah, that's what we do at the London Centre for Intuitive Eating.
Excellent, excellent. Right. I think we've solved everything now. Excellent. Yeah. Thank you, Laura. Now we're going to finish the podcast with a bit of a quick fire round. Are you ready?
Okay. I don't know why I feel so scared, but I do this to all of my guests and now I know what they feel like. Ooh, okay.
I know,
let's do it.
I was listening to your podcast last night. We were like and they're like, Oh gosh, I think it's the way we say it. I think you and I probably are very similar, like, right, we're gonna do the quick fire round now. Go. Like, oh god.
Panic.
All right, good.
Hit me.
All right. Yes, it's your turn now. Sit in the seat. Listen. All right, what makes you feel sexy, Laura?
Ooh, my husband.
Very good. Ooh. I want to meet him. What's your name?
No, he's my husband.
All right.
Just kidding. Shout out to Dave.
I'll save your job. What's your most favourite thing to put in your body?
Oh.
I mean, it can be the same answer as
number. I was going to say, can it also be my husband?
Yes, it can.
All right.
Okay, next question.
No one from the Association for Nutrition is listening.
In all the
if
holes.
I lose my registration.
Not an apple. Okay, what's your most embarrassing body moment?
I puked up into a pint glass in a club.
That is awesome.
I was like 18.
Yes.
So that's just,
let's
I'm definitely, cost. Definitely losing my registration.
You are not. Everyone's thrown up in some kind of receptacle. Sometimes it's a bucket. It's better than a handbag in a taxi. That's pretty.
I've probably done that.
Yeah, I've once like folded the jumper up. You know how you sort of folded up and then made a little jumper hammock for the sick. And then I knocked on the front door covered in pizza spew. And my husband
hammock.
Was like, oh, my God. And he just said, stay there. And I was like, what? And he said, I'm just going to take a photo. So that was nice.
I thought he was going to get a hose to just like spray you down.
But he was laughing and he's like, just stay there while I take a photo. Anyway, okay. Fat facts. Now, it was going to be a hard one because you're as a nutritionist with a PhD. I was like, oh, you'll know all facts about the body. But did you know that the mouth produces 1 liter of saliva every day?
I did not.
You did know that. Yeah. Okay, cool.
That's a weird thing that I had to learn for an exam recently. I just
did
a postgrad diploma in eating disorders and clinical nutrition. And you need to... I'm not going to bore you with the details of why I need to know that.
You just keep studying. You've already got a PhD and now you're getting an extra master's just on the side.
A diploma, but yeah, whatever.
Okay, cool. All right, she knows that, everyone. What an interesting fat fact. The Hall of Fat Fame.
Ooh.
So we have on the podcast the Hall of Fat Fame.
Yeah.
And which we like to put up on a pedestal a person, a woman, a man, who has inspired us and our relationship with our body. Have you got someone who does that? Previous people have been Bryony Gordon, mm-hmm. Sophie Hagen, Dawn French. Is there anyone who comes to mind?
Yeah, I am thinking of... Can I have two?
You may.
Okay. So on the fat yoga front, Jessamyn Stanley.
Yes,
is
amen.
Incredible. And the second is Charlotte Cooper, who is a fat activist, and she wrote a book called Fat Activism, and she's just a sensation. That
producer Emma, can we put those two people in the show notes so people can find these wizards of the human race?
I've done a podcast with Charlotte, and she started the Fat Olympics. I mean,
why don't I know about her? I feel I'm going. Said. Okay, we're stopping the podcast now. I'm going to find her and hug
Google
her.
Google Charlotte Cooper.
Charlotte Cooper, look out! And finally, Fatspiration. What is your mantra? Or what are the words that you live by, Laura? Like, if your life was a meme, or what do you like to say? Are there certain words or things you like to say to your clients?
The things that I always say to my clients over and over again are be curious, be kind to yourself, fuck diet culture, probably.
Yeah, I think that's the title of... Can we have that as the title of the podcast, producer Emma? Well, what can I say, Laura? Thank you. Thank you for being you, and thank you for being a champion for people everywhere who have struggled with food and now, after reading your book, have been transformed. I'm just talking about me again. I love your book very much. Please buy it. It's excellent. And and good luck. And what's next for you? You've written an amazing book. You've done an excellent podcast.
Mm.
What's next?
Well, I'm working on a new season of the podcast, and I'm actually just trying to slow the fuck down because I've been doing way too much. Mm. We've got some like in-person workshops that we're doing, some CPD training we're doing for other healthcare professionals, we're doing a workshop around emotional eating, one for raising and choose fears. That's kind of, we're working on that sort of thing.
You're busy.
Yeah.
But doing good shit.
Keep myself busy.
Do it. All right. I think that's the end. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you, Helen.
Oh, love you. All right. You've been listening to the Fat Lot of Good podcast hosted by me, Helen Thorne. You can follow me on Instagram at Helen Wears a Size 18 and, of course, at Scummy Mummies. And I just wanted to say I'm going to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival this year, all of August. So come up and see me there. And also a big shout out to our amazing sponsors, F&F Clothing, who I love. I love, I love, I love. And they have clothes from size 6 to size 22, and you can get them at next.co.uk and at FNF Clothing. And a shout out to lovely producer Emma Corsham, and the music was provided by John Thorne and jingles by Simon Toner. I think that's the end, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Do rate, review and subscribe. That's the end. Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.